the news podcast from Israel Next, the podcast for an inspired and credible Israel engagement. Ruor Sorensen is here behind the microphone. This is Inside Out, bringing you the perspectives, the Israeli perspectives on the news. And today is September 23rd. And this podcast has the potential to become very long. I will try to keep it short, which is a relative concept. Many think this is too long anyway. But I'll get right to the topics. We're going to talk about Israel, which is on the highest terror alert as the holidays are starting. And in New York, the Prime Minister, Yair Lapid, has revived the two-state solution. And for that, he receives applause from the White House. In East Jerusalem, a school strike sets their anti-Israeli curriculum in focus. And at the borders of Russia, there are people packed at the borders trying to get out, and some of them will end up in Israel, so Israel is preparing for a Russian aliyah. Then we have some news in short before we go to the weekly Torah portion. But first, again, we have to go to terrorism. So, Israel is on the highest terror alert, and that will last from tonight and until the 18th of October, when the holidays are over. And the terror attacks that we've been speaking about the last few weeks, they have continued also this week. What has been most in the media and was the most horrible was the murder of an 84-year-old woman in Holon. She was attacked by a Palestinian Arab worker that was working on a building nearby. And he got away, but later on he was found and he had hung himself in an abandoned building in Tel Aviv. Then there have been more terrorist attacks, a car ramming on a soldier in Hawara, which is just outside of Shechem, Nablus, and Shechem. And the soldier was lightly injured, but that area has become also like a hotspot now for terror attacks because it's very close to Nablus, which is another hotspot. Then in Modi'in, which is inside Israel, there was also an attack in an intersection where a terrorist got out of his car and started opening doors of other cars and stabbing people. And two got injured and well, it says there is eight that got a little injured, but two more seriously, but not too much, not life-threatening. And then in the end, the police officer shot him. This terrorist also used tear gas. Then for two nights in a row, there has been shooting attacks at Har Bracha, this Jewish settlement on the Mount Garizim, which is just above Nablus. And the terror organization or group of terrorists that has taken responsibility for this shooting is called the Lion's Den. And they're from Nablus, and they are terrorists composed of from different groups. And they're connected to Ibrahim Nabulsi, who was killed by Israeli security forces some weeks ago. He was a sought-after terrorist. So Nablus is a hotspot, really. And this is just like a selection of things that have been happening. Then, in Israeli media, and maybe where you live, there was also some focus on the fact that PA security forces, the Palestinian Authority security forces, they went out to arrest terrorists in Nablus, and that ended up in a shootout between these Palestinian Authority security forces and the terrorists. And what happened was that the two terrorists were arrested. Maybe there were more, but they were released. There were two that they were really after. But all of them were released just hours later. And this was unusual because it hasn't happened for a long time that the PA security forces has gone after terrorists. We have been talking about this. And so you have to ask the question, why did it happen just now, 2 days ago? And the answer is in New York, because Mahmoud Abbas was at that time, still is, in New York. And he was going to hold a speech in the UN, and he wanted to have something to show up that, yeah, we are fighting terror, or whatever they would call it, because they refuse to call it terrorism. Anyway, in all of this, it's the Temple Mount that is, again, the center, although not so much has happened around the Temple Mount yet, and hopefully it will not. But in New York again, King Abdullah, because all the leaders of the world almost are there, King Abdullah as well, and Yair Lapid, Israeli Prime Minister, so they too met. And Abdullah warned Lapid not to increase the number of visitors to the Temple Mount during the holidays. Well, that is not going to happen. There's going to be an increase of visitors, as there always is. And there's also an organization called, an Israeli organization called Beyadeinu, In Our Hands, that says that it will encourage people to visit the Temple Mount. They say that during this past year, because it's Jewish New Year starting on Sunday, and during this past year, 50,000 Jews have visited the Temple Mount. And next year, the goal is 100,000. And we're talking about Jews only. And of course, there have been more tourists as well. From other nations. So the Temple Mount then is in focus. The Jordanian king is worried because Jordan has a special responsibility in the Muslim world and because of their illegal occupation of East Jerusalem and the contact they then got to the Temple Mount. And that Israel has honored that contact, so they still give Jordan a voice in what goes on in the Temple Mount. And inside Jordan, that could also destabilize the regime because there's a lot of Palestinian Arabs living there. And they also have this as a main topic. So anyway, there's going to be more visitors. Just yesterday morning, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who is a Knesset member from a right-wing party, and he visited the Temple Mount. He does that now and then. But while he was there yesterday, he also put out a tweet and he said the following: "This morning, just before the end of the year and start of a new year, I went up to the Temple Mount to pray and to exercise sovereignty on the most holy site of the people of Israel. The people of Israel lives." So that is a quite bold tweet. And of course, he does this on purpose. He has long been fighting for the Jewish rights on the Temple Mount to pray there. And I have to say, I agree with that demand. And the question is how to achieve it. But anyway, so he goes up there and says, I went up there to pray and to exercise sovereignty. And of course, these are words that get the Muslim world up in arms because they don't want Jewish prayer on the Temple Mount. Now, the Supreme Court has said that they cannot forbid people from praying, but they are not allowed to have any outward signs that they're praying. So, but he also uses the word sovereignty, and of course, the Muslims feel that they are the ones that control this mountain. So, for instance, Hamas leader Mahmoud al-Zahar, one of the leaders, he says the following. He condemned what he called a blatant attack on the religious and Islamic status of the city and mosque. And he also said that Israel bears full responsibility for the possibility of dragging the entire region into an open religious war. He wasn't relating directly to Itamar Ben-Gvir, but to the fact that more and more Jews are visiting the Temple Mount. But anyway, he speaks about an attack on the religious and Islamic status of the city. And of course, in their eyes, this is what it is. It's a status of Islam. But as we've been speaking about many times on this podcast, the basis for all of this goes back to the Jewish presence. It goes back to the Bible. And if it weren't for the Bible and the Jewish Tanakh, the Old Testament, there wouldn't be neither churches in Jerusalem nor mosques. So it's a strange statement from a historical point of view. Anyway, the public security minister, Omer Bar-Lev, said that they will not limit visitors to the Temple Mount. Anyway, this terror threat, that's something that always increases during the holidays and in addition during the elections. And now we have both, like the elections will be in 40 days. So there is a tense situation. The police chief, Kobi Shabtai, said that there is an identifiable rise in terror alerts. And Israel is therefore mobilizing huge numbers of officers on the streets. And also they will close the check post, the so-called borders to Judea and Samaria. They are not really borders. But anyway, they will close these down for Palestinian Arabs so they cannot enter Israel. Of course, there will be those that enter anyway because they are able to get through the security fence or even where the fence has not been built yet. So, but there will be far fewer because also they cannot go to work in Israel during the holidays. There is no work going on for them. So, and there's also little, I mean, much less work. There's a lot of vacation time during this month that is ahead of us. So anyway, that's that about the terror threat. Then we come to Prime Minister Yair Lapid's speech in the UN General Assembly yesterday. And his tragic mistake to mention the two-state solution. But we will get to that. I made it a tradition here on the podcast, I think, 2 years. Already a tradition, to speak about and analyze the speech of the Israeli Prime Minister in the UN, because this is a very special opportunity for the Israeli Prime Minister to speak to the entire world. Now, unfortunately, during the last 3.5 years, there have been so many elections in Israel that every speech in the UN has become part of the election campaign in Israel. So much of the content has also been directed towards Israelis. But there is no doubt that it is important also for the Israeli Prime Minister to say a few words to the international community. And I must say that the speech of Yair Lapid, he is a good speaker. He knows how to present the message. So it was a good speech. And apart for this part that I've already mentioned about the two-state solution, I think there were many good points. So let's just take a look at some of the things he said. It's sad that many leave the room, many nations, they leave the room when Israel is speaking, and you could see that that there were many seats that were empty. But you can be confident that all of those nations that leave, they are very interested in what he is saying, so they will analyze this in detail in their own offices. Okay, so it was a great first part of the speech. He was detailing the miracle that Israel is, and this is something that Netanyahu also has done, and they keep doing. And it's important to remind the world that Israel, as Lapid did, he came after such a tragedy where 6 million Jews were murdered, and then not because of the Holocaust, but after the Holocaust, they established the state of Israel, and it has developed into one of the most prosperous states on earth, and definitely one of the most inventive, innovative ones. And they have made inventions that have helped the entire world so many times. Then Lapid went on to talk about the Abraham Accords, the normalization agreements with some of the Arab states, and the benefits of choosing peace, the cooperation that can come out of it, the development that can come out of it, even the freedoms that can come out of this. So, a good point in his speech. And then he spoke about the pluralistic Israeli society, where Arabs are found in all levels, I mean, like from the Supreme Court and to the government and all over society, and that the Arabs are partners in building the Israeli nation. But then he came to an important part, and I think it was one of his best, that there are two threats. There are threats for all of us, all nations, and that is a nuclear Iran. And the other one is the demise of truth. And then he went into first speaking about this demise of truth. And he said the following: reckless politicians, totalitarian states, and radical organizations are undermining our perception of reality. And this is very true. I agree with it. And as he said, also, Israel is threatened by this more than anyone. So then he made a very important point. He said, the question is not why do they do it? Why do they undermine the truth? But why are you willing to listen? Very good question there. Why are we giving ears to these lies? And then he said, anti-Semitism is the willingness to believe the worst about the Jews without questioning. Again, a very good point. And you can see that around the world that whenever something bad is said about Israel, there are very few that ask questions about it, critical questions. They just accept it because have been gotten used to this is what Israel does, this is how Israel is, because this massive media pressure on Israel and criticism against Israel. And then he also said, anti-Semitism is judging Israel by a different standard than any other country. So all of this is very good. But he could also have said that in addition to the fake news themselves, we also have reckless politicians, we have organizations, and we have journalists that have taken the role of deciding what is truth. Because we have the fake news, that's true, from all of these actors. But then we have other actors deciding for us that this is true and this is not true. And this they do based on political motivations, not based on the search for truth. And that is an even greater problem because it multiplies the original problem so many times. It gives a platform to some of those voices that of fake news, and it decides what is fake and what is not fake based on purely political motivations. That is a bigger problem, I have to say. The fact that a few reckless politicians have done this, brought fake news, that totalitarian states do it all the time, and organizations around the world do it all the time, that is one thing. But the fact that this is multiplied and amplified by the media, that is the big problem. Dan Lapid unmasked Iran. He just described this nation for what it is, breaking human rights and so on. And then he questioned the silence of the international community when Iran threatens to destroy Israel. And that is really, I mean, it's a question. Why is the international community silent when Iran threatens Israel with destruction? Why do they not take it serious? He said also, if the Iranian regime gets a nuclear weapon, they will use it. I don't know what he builds that statement on, but I mean, it's not unlikely. But he also said, Israel will not allow them to get a nuclear weapon. And that, of course, he was following Netanyahu and other prime ministers of Israel that have said they will not allow Iran to have nuclear weapons. But then Lapid left this topic and he got into the Palestinian Arabs and he made his major mistake. He lost direction. He said, Israel's economic and military strength allows us to protect ourselves. But it also allows us something else, to strive for peace with the entire Arab world and with our closest neighbors, the Palestinians. An agreement with the Palestinians based on two states for two peoples is the right thing for Israel's security, for Israel's economy, and for the future of our children. Peace is not a compromise. It is the most courageous decision we can make. Peace is not weakness. It embodies within it the entire might of human spirit. War is surrender to all that is bad within us. Peace is the victory of all that is good. And, you know, he is a good speaker. He can say things nicely. And this sounds very nice. But most of it is, I'm sorry to say, but it's nonsense. It's progressive svada. And when I use the word progressive, I use it in quotation marks, the way that it is used today. As a political direction and a political direction that is basically opposed to everything that is conservative, everything that has the conservative values we used to hold. That is progressive nowadays. So progressive is a really, well, it's the opposite of what it sounds like. Anyway, when he says like this, that war is surrender to all that is bad within us, is it really? Aren't there instances where war, taking to weapons to defend something, is the right thing to do? If Great Britain in 1939, when Hitler entered Poland, would have said, well, we won't raise our weapons, we will just sit and allow this to happen because war is surrender to everything that is bad, we might still live in a Nazi-dominated Europe. We might live in a Nazi Europe where there are no longer Jews, where there are no longer other so-called inferior humans, where there are no political opposition. I mean, because Great Britain and the Allied, they stood up against the Nazis, we have the freedoms that we do have. So sometimes you have to defend your freedom, and what is good, you have to defend it with weapons. So we'll come to why this is important, but of course, we come back to haunt his own statements, what he's saying here. So anyway, he uses this phrase, the two state, what does he say? Based on two states for two peoples. And that is sad because it brings back into the discussion a thing that was almost dead. It was definitely in the back seat, this idea about the Palestinian state. And he himself, Israeli, he brings it back on the forefront. Now, that is a big mistake, and I will come to why. But we will continue just quoting from his speech, because he said, we have only one condition for the establishment of Palestinian state. And he said, that a future Palestinian state will be a peaceful one. Really? Is that your only condition? And how are you going to guarantee that? Will you just take their word for it? That, yeah, we will have a peaceful Palestinian state, we will be peaceful, and that's it? Or will you demand guarantees? Like Netanyahu did when he accepted the Palestinian state. He did it on several occasions. We'll get back to that. But he at least put down some conditions. He said it must be a demilitarized state. Israel must keep the Jordan Valley. We will also keep some of the settlements. Jerusalem will be a united capital for Israel, and so on and so forth. There were many conditions that he laid down. But Lapid says we only have one condition, that it will be a peaceful state. So Lapid sounds like a realist and a dreamer in one person. A realist when it came to Iran, when it came to this, what he said about lies and that those things, and a dreamer when he started talking about Palestinian Arabs. And this is so typical. It's so typical of where the international community is, and especially then the center-left of the political spectrum. Lapid said when it comes to Iran that the world chooses not to believe the worst, despite all the evidence to the contrary. Israel does not have this privilege. This is what he said. I mean, that was the end of quote. The world chooses not to believe the worst, despite all the evidence, but Israel does not have this privilege. End of quote. So why does that apply to Iran, but not to the Palestinian Authority? You could have just entered the Palestinian Authority there, and it would be exactly the same, be as valid. Because you have all the evidence to the contrary, that when they negotiate for a state, they are not serious. You have all the evidence for it. I mean, they're not serious in the sense that they will allow also a Jewish state. So then he ended his speech by saying that we have proven that we are for peace. We have entered a peace agreement with Egypt 43 years ago, with Jordan 28 years ago, and with the Arab states a couple of years ago. And we keep our agreements. So he says, the burden of proof is not on us. And that's true. That's a good point. That was basically the main thing of his speech. Then some reactions. Joe Biden, president of the US, he put his full support behind Lapid in a tweet that he published, and he said, I welcome Prime Minister Lapid's courageous statement at the UN General Assembly. And then he quotes Lapid. An agreement with the Palestinians based on two states for two peoples is the right thing for Israel's security, for Israel's economy, and for the future of our children. End of quote. I could not agree more, he said. Okay. Interesting. So, out of everything that Lapid said, Biden chooses to comment on this item about the Palestinian Arabs. That is the least relevant, because there are no negotiations ongoing and there's no hope that they can start any time near in the near future. The PA is in a state of disintegration, so and it's not likely that a Palestinian state ever will see the light of day. It also the least urgent, as I said, there's nothing ongoing and it cannot ongo because the Palestinian Authority, there's a struggle for power going on inside there. Least relevant and least urgent, but it's at the same time the topic that is the most controversial or relevant inside Israel because of the elections. Because in every election, this is one of the main topics, the peace negotiations or the relationship to the Palestinian Arabs. This is one of the main topics on this the election is decided. And therefore, Biden goes straight into the Israeli election campaign when he tweets this. So what he's doing is he's really backing up the election campaign of Yair Lapid by putting his entire backing behind the prime minister. So the minute a Israeli prime minister has U.S. support, and U.S. is the strongest ally of Israel, of course, that means something for many Israelis. So Biden knows this, of course. He knows there's an election in Israel that will take place in 40 days. And he goes straight to that topic that can help Lapid the most. I mean, this is so not polite. This is so not correct thing to do, to be meddling in the Israeli election. Orit Struk, she is a right-wing parliamentarian in Israel, and she said, well, once again, everybody gathers around the golden calf. And she's so right. She calls this idea about the two-state solution the golden calf of the international community. And that's what it is. It has become something that they keep dancing around. It has been proven to be false, to not work, but they still keep dancing around it. And so let's get back to this thing. Why was it so bad that Lapid mentioned it? Well, the two-state solution is a dead end. It has been tried for almost 100 years, at least since 1937. And every time the Arabs have said no, they have not accepted it because they want it all. As long as it includes a Jewish state also, they don't want it. The two-state solution is really a recipe for more innocent death. That's what it has led to. If you look at the last 25 years since the signing of the Oslo Agreement, when this went into high gear and the establishment of a Palestinian state became like the idea, there has been so much bloodshed. There's been so much hatred that the Palestinian Arabs have distanced themselves from Israel. The gap between Jews and Arabs have increased tremendously, and so much terrorism has taken place. So what the talk about a Palestinian state does is that it empowers an evil regime, the Palestinian Authority, that thrives on the conflict, that educates its children to hate Israel, and that not only does that in the schools and in the mosques, in their media, but they even support terrorism themselves. So that's what the two-state solution is about. Once you say, I support the two-state solution, you support the Palestinian Authority, and you support more of this. So Lapid, he used this expression at the end of his speech, the burden of proof is not upon us. Well, in this case, it is. If you say that you are for a two-state solution, you really have the burden of proof on your side, that you need to prove that this is something that will be a good thing, because all the evidence speaks to the opposite. And it's so strange that suddenly you have another standard. One standard when it came to Iran, another standard when it came to this. You're dancing around the golden calf. Former Prime Minister Netanyahu released a video, and he said, it was during the speech even, but he said, Lapid is bringing the Palestinians back to the forefront of the world stage and is putting Israel right into the Palestinian pit. And that's true. What he's saying here is true. But, I mean, of course, the way I see it, but who is he to talk? You could really ask that question with a huge justification. Who is he to talk? Because if he has been speaking about the Palestinian state many times. But if I just go to his speech in the UN, same pulpit, in 2016, then he said the following. But I want you to know, I have not given up on peace. I remain committed to a vision of peace based on two states for two peoples. Israel welcomes the spirit of the Arab Peace Initiative and welcomes a dialogue with Arab states to advance a broader peace. I believe that for a broader peace to be fully achieved, the Palestinians have to be part of it. I'm ready to begin negotiations to achieve this today, not tomorrow, not next week, today. President Abbas spoke here an hour ago. Wouldn't it be better if instead of speaking past each other, we were speaking to one another? End of quote. So, as you see, Netanyahu has been speaking about this from the same pulpit, and so you might really ask, who is he to speak? But there is also a difference, and you could argue for that, that since the signing of the Abraham Accords, there is a new Middle East, because until that happened, the entire world, and especially the Israeli left, they said that there will be no peace until there is a peace with the Palestinian Arabs, until there is a Palestinian state. Then there will be no peace with the Arab nations around. And Netanyahu has always said that this is not correct, and he was proven right. So since last time Netanyahu was there and spoke, this has happened. So you could argue that, okay, that is the main difference. Now it would be wrong to speak about the Palestinian state. But then you could also argue against Netanyahu and say, well, why then did he push for a Palestinian state if he didn't believe it was necessary to achieve peace with the Palestinian Arabs? Why did he push for it? And unless you come to the answer that, well, he believes in it, then there is no really good reason. But if he believes in it, then you really have a problem. If he believes that there really should be a Palestinian state, because that's not what his party stands for. So here Netanyahu himself ends up in quite a catch-22. Why push for a Palestinian state back then if he didn't believe it was necessary? Yeah, in my opinion, he is for a Palestinian state. I mean, it's not that it is his dream, but he would be willing to accept this under certain conditions, but he would be willing to accept leaving Judea and Samaria, at least big parts of Judea and Samaria, for a Palestinian state. So, and that is problematic in my view. Okay. Then also, I just mentioned that there is this claim that, well, we have to give the Palestinian Arabs a political horizon. I mean, they have to have something to look forward to. They are stuck in a situation now. And this is true. I see this as well. You have to give them a so-called political horizon. But does that have to include a Palestinian state? No. Not in my opinion. It will take time to change this because we have now been working, almost 100 years, but definitely the last 25 years, with just one thought in mind, a Palestinian state. So it will take time to change this. But a Palestinian autonomy, on the other hand, I could see. But you have to get rid of the regime that is now ruling them. It's an evil leadership that they have that is more busy with getting money for himself, corruption, than they are with what is good for the people. And you need to install the local clan leaders, the local leaders that really have a heart for their people and for their cities. They need to take responsibility. And then you need to start improve the conditions for them, their work conditions, economic, finances, and so on, traveling and so on. You need to make their lives normal. And get rid of all this propaganda and hatred in the schools. So this is a long way to go, but that is the way that can lead towards a true peace. Now, when Lapid speaks about a peaceful nation, peaceful Palestine, that is really naivety when you look at their textbooks. And that's what we're going to do right now. We're going to look at their textbooks because we're going to talk about schools in East Jerusalem. And right now there's a strike going on in some of these schools. And that's a strike that has been organized by a committee for the parents together with some organizations, and including Hamas and Fatah and some teachers. But it's not like a wide, like all over the schools. Because in East Jerusalem, there are so many school systems. You have schools that are having the Israeli curriculum. You have schools that have the Jordanian curriculum, schools that have the Palestinian Authority curriculum. And then you have schools that have British or French curriculum because they belong to these. All of these are like private schools. So there's a chaos when it comes to uniformity. There is no uniformity at all in these schools. And because of that, a few years ago, a government under Netanyahu started a program called the Chumash program. And the idea was to offer these schools budgetary incentives, I mean, give them finances to, if they would accept the Israeli curriculum. Of course, the government saw that there's a big problem with the anti-Israeli curriculum that is there, and we will get to that. So we need to get in a proper curriculum. It's not like in Israeli propaganda, it's an objective curriculum. So they offered to finance the school systems if they took in this curriculum. And some schools did, and it has been spreading. But has been spreading under the radar because Israel does not want to brag about it or speak about it because they know it will provoke certain forces in the Palestinian Arab world. So what this does as well, in addition to get more objective teaching, is that it gives these students the opportunity to continue studying in Israeli higher education, in the high school, in the universities and colleges. So it's really good for themselves, as it is now. When they come out of these other school systems, they have to go through more education and tests before they can come into Israeli higher education. So then I listened to an interview with Mohammed Majadle, who is one of the reporters in the Israeli main channel, Channel 11. And he's an Israeli Arab. He grew up in East Jerusalem and he went through this school system. And so there was a Hebrew podcast with him, and I was just listening. And he says that in these schools, they teach us that, I mean, he went to one of the most conservative schools, And he said, they teach us that the police and the Israeli authorities, I mean, all of these, they are against us. They are just out to get us. Teach us that 1948, Israelis came, they stole our land. They teach the Nakba version of what went on, meaning the Nakba is the catastrophe. In Israel, of course, 1948, the 14th of May, is the day of independence. I mean, the day when Israel was established. But among the Arabs, it's the catastrophe, the Nakba. So they give this Nakba version of events that Israel came and stole their land and cast out their grandparents. And then in 1967, they cast out their parents and so on. This is what they're told. And on our maps, everything is Palestine. From the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, everything is Palestine. So Majadla, he sits there in this podcast and he says, yeah, this is what we were taught in East Jerusalem. They teach us also history, Arabic, and they teach us social sciences, but social sciences from a Palestinian Arab point of view, a Palestinian Authority point of view. And that excludes all teaching about Israeli democracy. There's nothing about an Israeli parliament. There's nothing about voting rights for Arabs. There's nothing about the Supreme Court. There's nothing about how Israel works. In their curriculum, there's no Holocaust. Never took place. There is, all the cities on the maps, of course, are with Arab names, including Jerusalem. There's no East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem. There's Jerusalem, but it's Al-Quds. And even Tel Aviv has an Arab name, and that's peculiar because Tel Aviv was just sand dunes when it was established. So anyway, but there's just Arab names everywhere. But he said there was no encouragement to terror in his curriculum. It was not that they say, go and take a knife and go out and stab somebody. But except for that, like the groundwork for this hatred was being led in the schools. So this is, of course, very disturbing, especially when you think of that East Jerusalem is completely Israel. It's a part of Israel proper. Israel has annexed that part of Jerusalem. The international community does not regard it as Israel, but Israel themselves do. And it's Israeli law that is valid in East Jerusalem. But in spite of that, they allow all these school systems and all these curriculum to flourish. So one must really hope and pray that this strike will fail and more schools will allow to take in a sound view of history and the Israeli curriculum, and that these more moderate forces will win, because the fact that so many schools already have taken it in shows that there are these moderate forces. So anyway, it was just an interesting thing that is going on here, and we just hope and pray that it will develop for the best, so that again, generation can grow up in East Jerusalem that is has their minds set towards integration with Israel. Then we come to Russia and war against Ukraine. And as a result of what happened a few days ago when Putin said that Russia will call up 300,000 soldiers, mobilize them, then this has led to a flight. People are fleeing Russia. They are going long lines at the borders. And if it's the border to Georgia or Moldavia or Finland, even Norway, there's a lot of people at the borders trying to get away, get out of Russia, either not to get mobilized into the army or because this is enough, they have had enough. And many of them, of course, are strong critics of this special operation that Putin calls it, the war on Ukraine. So there was a report in Israeli radio about one reporter was at the border to Finland, and he saw these long lines, and he spoke to some of the people. They didn't want to be identified, But they said they criticized really Putin, they criticized the war. And there were people of all ages, not just people of that were like going to the military. So and I also heard that spreading around among those people that can be called up to the military, there was this, how do I break my hand in such a way that I cannot be mobilized for the army? And this is just like a flashback for the Jews. This is like a flashback going back to when they themselves were under the Tsar regime in Russia, and they would be called up for military service, and they would cut off a finger or two to not be compatible, not be eligible to go to the army. And at that time, of course, it was 25 years also, military service. So anyway, it's terrible what is going on. And we really hope that this may get Russia to wake up to get rid of this evil regime and get an end to the war. Anyway, in Israel, they are now preparing for Aliyah because there are still many Jews that are left in Russia. And they assume that now many will come and would want to make Aliyah. So in the end, for that sake, it would be like a positive thing both for Israel and for these people that are coming. So Israel has is preparing. They have had meetings. They are preparing financial packages and also places for them to live as they come. So that's the Israeli viewpoint. Then another court news, short news about the court. I talked about this committee and the committee head that had been appointed by the government. I talked about it in the podcast a year, last week or the week before. And this committee and the committee head, they were supposed to appoint important positions in the Israeli society, such as the chief of staff of the Israeli army. And this appointment of this committee head was supposed to be for 8 years. And it's, as I said, appointed by the current government coalition. Now, if you appoint somebody for 8 years, it means that he will be sitting for at least two governments ahead. And when you do that just before the election, this becomes very suspicious. But you kind of put down limitations on what future governments can do, because this committee head will be sitting there and he will be appointing these leaders in society. And according to his political views, that becomes a problem. And he has made, the committee head, Meni Masous, he has made his views very clear. He's way on the far left. So anyway, this came to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court said you have to think this over. And then this week, the Supreme Court said this is not good enough. You cannot do this. So they rejected the decision made in the government. And that is good, because it really was an attack on the Israeli democracy if this would happen, that the outgoing transitionary government could make such a decision. The other dilemma here is that it was the Supreme Court again throwing down a government decision. And we talked about this as well, that this has happened many times, that the Supreme Court is denying or annulling a government decision. And that is a problem in itself, because the Supreme Court is not elected. The government, the parliament, is elected. And in a democracy, elected persons should make the decisions. So there is a dilemma here, but I have to say in this case, the Supreme Court is supporting the democratic rules. So it was a good decision. And the last thing in short here is election update. There have been three polls coming out yesterday, and all of them show that the right-wing bloc is progressing, but they show at a different speed. So one poll from Channel 12 said that the right-wing receives 60 seats. Channel 14, which is the most right-wing, I mean, it's the only right-wing channel in Israel, they say that the right-wing bloc receives 62 seats, and Channel 13, which is a left-wing, I mean, all the other channels are really left-wing. I mean, they say to be neutral, but they tend towards center-left. Anyway, so Channel 13 said that the right wing will receive 61 seats. And you might wonder, well, does the poll itself, is it influenced by the channels and their viewpoints? Well, It seems like that right now, since Channel 14, the right-wing channel, gave them 62, the most. Anyway, it seems that there's a tendency that the right wing is strengthened, and this comes, of course, as a result of the fact that Arab Party was split again. So now the Arab parties have even less mandates in the Knesset. Of course, that is if the elections were today, but they are in 40 days. So anyway, we come to Parashat HaShavua, and that's Nitzavim from Deuteronomy 29:9 until Deuteronomy 30:20. Nitzavim comes from this standing. You are placed. You stand here before the Lord. But it's not just to stand. It's really to stand before the Lord in this instance. Okay. A summary of this is Moses is talking to Israel as they are standing before the Lord. He reminds them of the covenant that they are in with God. And he warns them not to disobey the laws, the commandments, thinking that it will still be well with them. If they do so, their land will be desolate and they will be spread out and the nations will mock them. But then, when they return to God, he will bring them back from their captivity. And God will make them prosperous. He will circumcise their hearts. And God will again rejoice over Israel as he did over the fathers, if they obey his commandments. For the commandment is not far away. It's not in heaven or beyond the sea. The word is very near you, in your mouth and in your heart. And God says, I set it before you, life and good, death and evil, blessing and cursing, and therefore choose life. Then you may dwell in the land that God gave to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So this is basically what it's all about. And then some comments. And one headline you could make is that we do not know it all, but we can do it. So that is based on one of the verses in this parasha that goes like this. The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but those things which are revealed belong to us and our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. And this is interesting. It says here that there are secret things. There are things that we do not know. And in one way, that is like a relief. That's very good. Because sometimes you want to know everything and you try to know everything, but you realize you don't make it. And God says, well, there are things that you shouldn't know. These are secret things and they belong to God. But what has been revealed is more than enough for you to make it, because these are given to us and our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. So it's possible to live as God wants us to by what we do know. And that's the beauty of it. God is not like mysterious in a bad way, that he's hiding things for us and wanting us to fail. Not at all. He is hiding things, things we cannot see and know. But everything that we do need to know to live fully, we have. So that's a really encouragement. So this means that it's not in difficult philosophical ideas that we need to engage. It's not in scientific theories and paradigms. Or it's not in a religious seeking to one's inner self and trying to find one inner self or try to self-extinct. It's none of these things that give us what we need. I mean, you could definitely go into philosophical ideas and you can definitely go into science and paradigms, but that's not what gives you the life. The life is in his laws and his commandments so that we can live it. So God is near us in our life. The word is near you, it says. He wants us to include him, and therefore we shouldn't treat him as a stranger. That means that he is near in our thoughts, in our work, our conversations with others, our prayers, our Bible readings or gatherings, but also, I mean, in so-called religious things and in day-to-day things. He is near. Now, charismatic Christians have lost a lot, in my opinion, because there are so many ways that we could have let God enter our world in a very practical sense, but we have not done it because we have spiritualized things. So we have almost chemically removed physical objects as part of the service of God. For instance, like meals, candles, tassels, fixed prayers, bodily movements or positions, fixed Bible readings, mezuzah, this little container with the word of God in it on the doorpost, instruments like a shofar, all of these things, they can carry a divine presence. I mean, that's what God gave. Some of these things is very clear in the Bible. This is what God gave us so that we could be reminded of him. And some of them, they carry a divine presence. Like we do have it in the meal, in this communion. There we do have it. Sometimes we use prayer cloth. There we also believe that a physical thing can have a divine presence. But there are many other things that we don't have. And that, for instance, Jews have. And the historical churches also have. So this is something that could help us focus and bring God into our life, because he is near. And sometimes, since we just have him in our thoughts, in our hearts, we don't see this, and it becomes more difficult for us. So I believe there is something here to learn for charismatic Christians, to unspiritualize everything or things, and see that even physical things can help us draw near to God. Now, when you talk about the word as Jesus, as we do in the New Testament, of course, this becomes even stronger. If the word is near you in your mouth, in your heart, then, of course, this gets another dimension to it. And towards the end of this podcast, I just want to read six verses that kind of are history foretold. And that's Deuteronomy 30:1-6. Now, remember, this was said back in the time of Moses, I mean, meaning this is like 1500 years before Christ. And then God really speaks about the history of the Jews. But he says, this is what will happen. And then he says the following. Now it shall come to pass when all these things come upon you, the blessing and the curse which I have set before you, and you call them to mind among all the nations where the Lord your God drives you, and you return to the Lord your God and obey his voice according to all that I command you today, you and your children, with all your heart and with all your soul, that the Lord your God will bring you back from captivity and have compassion on you, and gather you again from all the nations where the Lord your God has scattered you. If any one of you are driven out to the farthest parts under heaven, from where the Lord your God will gather you, and from there he will bring you, then the Lord your God will bring you to the land which your fathers possessed, and you shall possess it. He will prosper you and multiply you more than your fathers. And the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your descendants to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, that you may live. Amen. So this is so amazing words, because it really speaks about the history of Israel before it happens. And when you look at this today, it's really a miracle, because for generations, generation after generation that have been preceding us, like if you talk about from the time of Jesus and until modern times, so many generations were living and they were reading these things and they say, well, when would that ever happen? Will it ever happen? I mean, most of them didn't believe it would happen because they had gone into replacement theology. But then there were those, but it was so far away, it was so not relevant. And today, you and I are living in the time when these things are happening. It's just such a miracle, and it's just such a sign of God's faithfulness. So this is really encouraging, of course, towards Israel and what God is doing with Israel. and even towards us, that God is a faithful God. So praise God for his faithfulness, and as you can see in these verses. So I will end with a priestly blessing as usual. Just thank you also for listening and for spreading the news about this podcast. It really helps us. And also, if you want to support us, we are really happy to receive your support. So thank you for that. You can find it on our website, israelnext.com. You can find the give button there. Of course, also, if you would pray for us, that will help us a lot as well. So let us finish with a priestly blessing. Yavarechecha Adonai v'yishmerecha. Ya'er Adonai panav elecha v'yechuneka. Yisa Adonai panav elecha v'yasem lecha shalom. Thank you for listening, and until next time, say something good about Israel.